Mr. Adamson, Reel 7. You were in Normandy, as you say, in August, and a lot of fighting had gone on there, and the Normandy campaign was coming towards its end, if it didn't end in August, and the pursuit started. So you were seeing the battle area. What were you seeing?
Well, we used to, once we transferred from the tank transporter regiment, or company, into General Transport Company, your duties were mixed. They were of several natures. You could be carrying petrol, you could be carrying ammunition, and you loaded it from the various petrol dumps and ammo dumps, and you took it to forward positions for whatever company or regiment or it was supplying it to. So your duties were mixed in a lot of ways. And we used to drive a 10-ton Mack truck. These were American trucks, diesel engine with a Mack Lenover engine in them. But they were quite handy. And we drove them, as I say, our duties were various.
Until the captured ports, a lot of this was still coming off the beaches.
A lot of it was coming off the beaches, and then it was taken inland to the various dumps, the beachheads and things like that.
And you were getting them from the dumps, were you, rather
than
the beaches?
Yeah.
So were you long distances involved, because the army was racing ahead at this time?
As the months went on, the distances became longer, as you'll appreciate. Sometimes a distance of 15, 20 miles was an average. Then later on, the distances became somewhere in the region of 100 miles from one depot to another depot.
How many hours a day would you be driving?
Sometimes you could do 8, sometimes you could do 10. There were no restrictions, there were no limitations on your driving. It was as and where, and wherever you were wanted.
Was it usually in a convoy situation with other
trucks? Yes.
What was the convoy discipline?
Usually I had an officer with the convoys, as well as the NCOs.
And were you governed in speed and distance apart from each other?
Oh, yes. The convoy was usually with an officer. There was an officer at the front. An officer would consist of an officer. More often than not, a water truck, which carried a small water truck, incidentally, probably 300 or 400 gallons or something like that. But it was all water which had been put in the tank and had gone through a purification process because of the situation of water in France and in Normandy in particular. So it had gone through a purification process. And then there'd probably be the coke wagon. So there'd be the officer, there'd be the water wagon and coke wagon, and then the convoy. You had a convoy NCO, and you would also have a dispatch rider going up and down the convoy, making sure everybody kept pace, kept within a certain distance of each other. And the back of the convoy, more often than not, would be the convoy mechanic. And he was responsible for any truck that had failed for whatever reason, mechanical or otherwise, and from the front of the convoy to the back, he would be responsible for repairing it and getting it back into its position. So convoy discipline was strict, as you'll appreciate.
What distances apart would you be from the truck in front of you in daylight? So you would travel
in daylight, no more than maybe a couple of truck lengths. And at night, in those days, your headlight was masked, except for a little slot, which was approximately about half an inch to three quarter of an inch wide, and probably about 3 to 4 inches. There were no red rear lights. The differential of the truck was painted white, and on top of the differential was another little light which illuminated the differential, so that the only thing you could see was in front of you was not a set of tail lights or a set of stop lights. It was the illuminated differential light, and that's what you had to focus on in those days.
And not much light to see with.
No.
Were there accidents?
Yes. Inevitable. I don't think any of them ever became... I think there was only one serious accident that I can ever remember. And it was later on in that year. And we were moving down in towards the Ardennes area. And unfortunately, one small vehicle, I think it was the water vehicle, the one who carried the water, and there was a cook's orderly alongside the water truck driver who was responsible for loading the water truck and also injecting the purification tablets and everything else that purified the water. And he, for some reason or other, had broken down and had been repaired by the mechanic at the back. And once the repairs had been effected, he was then told to rejoin his place in the convoy, which was second or third from the front. And unfortunately, the roads, as you mentioned before, about being narrow, to pass the line of convoy, the convoy of trucks, he'd had to drive it sometimes with his two offside wheels, as you'll appreciate driving on the right. His two offside wheels were quite often off the road in muddy patches. And unfortunately, one, he was probably putting a bit of speed on to try and catch up his position. But at one particular spot, having to put a lot of right-hand drag on his steering wheel to try and keep him in a straight and narrow path, he must have hit a certain spot where the road, in fact, was a little bit harder, because the water wagon suddenly veered across the road and smashed straight into a tree, probably 20 or 30 yards in front of me. When that part of the convoy suddenly braked because of the accident, the truck was upside down and the lad was underneath it, the driver, and the cook orderly was sat holding his nose on a side. At that particular time, there was an American officer and a driver were coming the other way, and they stopped to see if they could offer any assistance. And as it happened, the officer turned out to be a doctor. They examined the lad that was underneath the truck, and unfortunately he was dead. He was a young lad. He'd only come to join the company early that year, having done his 6 months initial training in England and then posted out of the company. So he hadn't much of a life, or say much of his life, in the army. But the other lad was sat holding his nose, and in fact his nose was split and broken right across the middle. He was taken away and seen to by the army doctor, the American army doctor. The other lad that was underneath the truck was declared dead. The water truck was rerouted, and eventually that was put to one side, and the body of the dead soldier was actually loaded on the back of a truck until we got to our destination.
What was convoy speed as a rule during the day?
15, 20 miles an hour, something like that. It was never anything excessively fast.
Were there periods of time when there was a pressure on you, you had to get stuff forward quickly, and meant you drove long hours?
I remember coming out of Brussels. I think, if my memory serves me right, the the area we were loading ammunition, and of course it was going up to a forward position into Germany, and these Maklanova trucks, their exhaust travelled the full length of the lorry. The tail of the exhaust, as you'll appreciate, being at the back. So I don't think there were any battles in the exhaust, because the noise used to make was absolutely tremendous. And with a Maklanova engine, which was a big engine to start with, and we'd been loading this ammunition up on a place called, I think it was the Bassenwehrcourt in Brussels, and I loaded up, and I came out from the loading area, the Bassenwehrcourt, and we had to go over a weirbridge. And as I came over the weirbridge, I think the load on the back, there were a 10-ton truck, and I think the load on the back of my truck must have been either 12 and a half to 13 ton, which was quite a weight. And nevertheless, I turned around and said, well, this ammunition is required. Just give me the consignatory note, I'll sign it, and that's it, which I did do. And we were coming up between the boulevards in Brussels. The course with them being lined with trees, and the noise these Maklanova engines made, and especially when they were fully loaded, because they were pulling. And I remember the noise, I could hear it reverberating between the lines of trees in the boulevard. And I remember being pulled up by a military policeman. He said, you seem to be rather overloaded, and you were going at such and such a speed. And of course, when I pleaded with him that the ammunition was needed, his remark was, well, until you get out of Brussels, just take it easy. But we got to our destination without any problems.
The people of the liberated countries that you were meeting as you went along, how were they treating you? How
did you get along? Oh, they treated us as heroes. We were made very, very welcome, no matter where you went. Belgium, France, Germany itself, even at times, I think. I think the animosity that probably existed between German and Allied troops, It wasn't as bad as it was made out to be. There were obvious incidents, but generally speaking, I think even the Germans were glad to see the war coming to somewhat of a close.
You say you had to take your ammunition, whatever it was, close to the front line, obviously.
Yes.
How close? Were you becoming under fire?
Not the ammunition dumps themselves. If you had a small amount and you were to take it to a gun sight, say on the outskirts of Boulogne, yes, there were occasions where, in fact, as you were actually dropping ammo off, that particular gun sight was being bombarded by jerrys inside of Boulogne. But generally speaking, I don't think we were in a great deal of danger.
You didn't come close to anything yourself?
No.
So you've taken supplies to the British Army, and with the same...
Sometimes American Army. We were at one particular time, later on, when we finished up around the Ardennes area, we were actually working in close proximity with the American forces. You used to go and take your orders at times from their officers and join in their commanders, their convoys, I should say.
How did you find them, the Americans?
At times, hair-raising. Well, we'd been used to pretty reasonable speeds with the American trucks, and their range of trucks varied. Their speed was hell-bent, in other words, hell for leather. And if you were behind an American and you were in convoy, it sometimes was very, very hard to keep up with them. Very hard. when all you were looking at was a little white light on the back of a differential lit with a bulb about 2.5 or something like amps.
Were they mainly coloured drivers, the Americans?
Yes, yes. They were the ones most difficult to keep up with.
But as people themselves, how did you get on with them?
Very well. Very well. I think the only time I ever came across animosity between groups of people, and it might be because of the nature of the... We were at one time closely associated with some Canadian troops. And unfortunately, the Canadian troops at that time that we were with were French-Canadian, and they were very volatile. Very volatile. It paid you the time to keep your distance from them and keep yourself away from them. Otherwise, you never knew where you were going to be involved in trouble with them. There was animosity existed. But that animosity also existed between Canadian and French Canadian, so there was nothing strange to them.
So you drove then, you went through the whole of the advance, basically, in France.
Yes.
And into Germany itself.
Yeah.
What outstanding memories have you of Germany?
Of the Germans? I think the only one particular instance I remember, and I can't think where it was actually, but I remember pulling into this small, very small town, village, much more than a village actually, and we pulled off the road and the lorries were just stood and the drivers and the mates had disembarked and we just stood by the lorries. And there was a group of young lads, probably 16 to 18 year old. And of course they were showing acts of bravado, which didn't go down very well with our lads. One lad in particular, and I remember, was bragging about how he'd been with the Wehrmacht and all the rest of it. And in no uncertain terms, he didn't walk away from where he was. But generally speaking, I think they accepted defeat, and we didn't brag about it.
Did you see anything of displaced persons or concentration?
Oh, yes, yes. When I was going through Belgium, I was in a place called Charleroi, or Charleroi. I don't know how you pronounce it, it's Charleroi. And I damaged a couple of fingers on my hand when replacing a wheel on the truck. And in fact, I finished up with two lovely black nails at that particular time. But I'd had occasion during night, those two black nails had caused me some discomfort. When I reported for medical attention the following morning, I was sent to a local army unit, which was an American doctor, then actually punctured both nails and released the blood and released the pressure under the nail, which eased a lot of the pain. But while I remember when I was in that doctor's surgery, I remember looking, it was upstairs, and I remember looking down and seeing dozens and dozens and dozens of displaced persons of all nationalities that had been taken from their own countries into forced labour camps in Germany, and they were in displaced person camps in the in and around that area. And as I say, they were all nationalities. There were Poles, there were Russians, everything you can think of that area of Central Europe.
Did you see any of the concentration camps themselves?
The concentration camp. The only one concentration camp I wanted to go into was Belsen. When I'd found out inadvertently in a town centre that, in fact, this old regiment of mine, the 2nd 5th DLI, which had now 113 Light Attack Regiment, were in fact in occupation in Belsen, and we'd been delivering some ammunition up to a aviation spirit. we'd been delivering aviation spirit up to a big dump, which wasn't too far away from Belsen. And I pleaded to the camp commandant, the convoy commander, to allow it to visit the camp, mainly because a very good friend of mine was also the regimental sergeant major, and I asked him if it was possible to dive there from our usual journey back home to go and visit this camp. And Belsen concentration camp by this time, I think, was divided into either three or four camps, and at least two of those camps were boarded up, and a lot of scientists and people like that from England had gone over to examine the camps and the people, the inmates of those camps, and we were allowed to see the others. And I must admit that the fourth camp was where the occupants of the camp, i.e. the British military, were actually housed. The third camp were people who were actually inmates of the camp that had been prisoners of the Germans. And in fact, they were the people that would probably recover and eventually go to live a life afterwards. But even what I saw of those in that particular time was a terrible sight. It's totally inhuman altogether. And I've seen photographs afterwards of the conditions in the first two camps, and they're absolutely beyond belief.
Was there the smell about the place, the fan, did you
have? Not that one would really notice. And in fact, from the outside of the camp itself, it was a huge camp, and from the outside of the camp, it was iron railings right round it. One seems to wonder how people that lived in close proximity to those camps didn't know what was going on. But then again, I think with the circumstances in Germany, it was a case of see all, hear all, see all, and say nothing. Otherwise, you'll probably finish up in the camp with them.
Where were you when war ended in Germany?
I was about 6 or 8 miles from Hamburg. I'd heard a rumour, strange enough, I heard a rumour a week previous about an armistice being signed. Although that rumour never was substantiated, that rumour nevertheless was flying about where I was. And then a week later, when we were near Hamburg, we were taking a party of Marines up to the Hamburg area, to Hamburg Naval Barracks. And these Marines were part of harbour restoration groups. You know, there were divers and people like that that used to go and assess damage to harbour installations and things like that. And we took these Marines up to this barracks in Hamburg. And I remember that when we approached the barracks, in fact, the German guard was still on it. Needless to say, they weren't there for very long. But we went into these barracks at Hamburg, and while we were there, and before we returned to our own base unit, we were told that, in fact, the war had ended, and an armistice was being signed on Lüneburg Heath, which was further over towards...
What was your reaction?
I think it was a case of... For people like myself that had been in from before the war, 10 days, bearing in mind that I'd been in from 10 days prior to the war actually being declared, it was a case of, when am I going home? Within a short space of time of the armistice being signed, arrangements had been made. on the discharge of troops, on what was known then as an age and service. And your age and service eventually brought you a number. And as and when that number was reached, you eventually were discharged.
Before we come to that, did you have any celebrations when the war ended, when the news came through?
Not really. Probably a few drinks in the local bar, if you could get any. But I think people were just generally pleased to say the whole thing was finished. I don't think there were any parading around the streets for the Union Jacks or Stars and Stripes or anything like that. I think it would be much different to the celebrations that eventually took place in London.
Where did you get to immediately after the end of the war? Where did they send you?
Once the war was over, the amount of lorries and, in fact, transportation equipment was greatly in excess of the need. There were no longer the journeys from one end of, say, Cali up to the front line or anything like that. And in fact, a lot of the equipment then was to be taken back to depots. And various companies became what are called ferrying companies. And vehicles were taken by the various Army Service Corps units and dropped on disused airfields and places like that. Eventually, most equipment, the excess of lorries, I might be wrong, but I think at that particular time, I think the Royal Army Service Corps comprised about one-fifth of the British Army with their drivers and the likes, and also the equipment. And that necessity suddenly disappeared. The need for that amount of equipment and men suddenly was no longer required. So units were then formed into what are called ferrying companies. And all the equipment was taken from various airfields, disused airfields, or occupied airfields in Germany, down as far as Cali. And there they were placed on ships and eventually sent back to England. And I eventually became part of, after this operation was finished and the bulk of the transport was dispersed and dispersed, I joined a HQ car company, and the HQ car company was basically for driving officers about from HQ. And this was an Army HQ, and there were two HQs. There was what they called Forward HQ and there was Rear HQ. Rear HQ was at a place called Hereford, and Forward HQ was at a place called Bad Oeynhausen in Germany. And that's where I was stationed, Bad Oeynhausen.